Hello, 안녕하세요, and welcome to the latest episode of the North Korea podcast, now in partnership with The Diplomat, the leading news source for Asian affairs. This is a show where we look over the 38th parallel and into the world's most secretive, intriguing, and to many the most frightening country on the planet. Why does a small country of 25 million people matter and so often dominate the headlines? This week we are talking all about the North Korea Congress. We're going to be speaking to Anna Fifield, the fantastic Tokyo bureau chief for the Washington Post, who was actually inside Pyongyang during the Congress itself. We will also be speaking to Connie Kim, who is a North Korea reporter for Arirang TV. The North Korea Congress, the first to be held in 36 years since the last one in 1980, was billed as a big coming of age for Kim Jong-un. As ever with North Korea, no one quite knew what to expect. Was Kim Jong-un going to announce a major change of policy? Were the reporters finally going to be given more access? Our reporter Simon Harris has more.
정결기간 우리 당과 인민은 위대한 수령님과 위대한 장군님의
현명한 In a three-hour speech broadcast on North Korean TV, Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un set out a five-year plan to revive his country's struggling economy. But the speech included no major policy changes or economic reforms. Kim delivered the speech during the 7th Congress of the Workers' Party of Korea, where more than 3,400 party members attended. He called for greater exports of raw materials, but did not say how this was going to be possible in the wake of heightened UN sanctions after this year's hydrogen bomb and missile tests. The speech focused extensively on the struggles and the progress of North Korea since the last party congress in 1980. Kim repeatedly referenced North Korea's Juche ideology of self-reliance, but also spoke of a desire to increase foreign trade. The leader spoke of his country's economic collapse in the 1990s on the heels of the implosion of the former Soviet Union, followed by a period of famine and hardship known locally as the Arduous March. In recent years, there have been signs of a modest economic recovery in the capital. There is more traffic, restaurants and consumer items such as smartphones, electronics and fashionable clothing. Some estimates say the North Korean economy has grown by around 1% annually over the last 3 years. If there was no detail, there was plenty of rhetoric, including promises to improve his people's living standards, such as generating more electricity. Even in the capital, where citizens enjoy the highest living standards in the nation, many residents have electricity for just a few hours in the morning and evening. Kim's address highlighted his policy of pushing economic growth and nuclear armament simultaneously. He pledged North Korea would not use its nuclear weapons unless its sovereignty is encroached upon by aggressive hostile forces with nukes. This got one of the biggest cheers of the day. In the highly secretive country where the government controls information, even among its own officials, foreign journalists and their government minders had a confusing time. After being told to dress formally, more than 100 journalists were driven to the People's Palace of Culture, a venue where press conferences are often held. Outside, there was a line of black Mercedes-Benz sedans with 727 license plates reserved for high-ranking party members. Reporters were told to bring their passports and equipment inside for a security check, but after members of the media waited in the lobby for around an hour, an official from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs announced the programme had changed, and the journalists were driven back to their hotel, where they stayed for the remainder of the day. The state-controlled media continues to be the only source of information for international reporters in the capital. They've been taken on sightseeing tours around the city, but were given no access to the party congress or any government officials. Reporters were, however, allowed to take pictures and video while standing across the street from the party congress venue. A BBC team led by Rupert Wingfield Hayes was expelled for upsetting the regime.
That was an interesting take there from Simon Harris, who mentioned about the North Korean economy and the purpose of the Congress. Now, I also spoke to Connie Kim, who is a North Korea correspondent for Arirang TV. I asked Connie more about what the actual purpose of the North Korea Congress was and what we can learn from it.
The Seventh Workers' Party was held to legitimize young Kim Jong-un's leadership following his father's death in late 2011. So expectations were pretty high that Kim Jong-un will lay out a new blueprint for North Korea's future, namely the economy. But if we take a closer look at Kim's five-year economic development plan, there's nothing really specific. So he pointed out energy shortage was a grave problem holding back the economy, but it definitely fell short of offering the specifics. And another thing to closely watch for was replacing his senior aides to relatively young officials, but that also fell short of expectations as well. So the Standing Committee of the Party's Political Bureau, which is considered the main inner circle of Kim Jong-un, he added two members, Party Secretary Choi Ryong-hae and Cabinet Member Park Bong-ju. So in the nuclear front, we can say the Congress was used to reaffirm North Korea's status as a nuclear state. North Korea adopted the so-called Pyongjin policy. It's the twin economic and nuclear weapons development, literally aiming to isolate the regime further in the international community.
This Pyongjin policy, which is combining nuclear weapons capabilities and economic reform, is this the key, do you think, to keeping Kim Jong-un in power for a long period of time?
What we do know is that Kim Jong-un is aiming to expand its nuclear arsenal with its Pyongjin policy, of course. But then since the international community keeps on pressuring Kim Jong-un to give up its nuclear arms, if he goes ahead with another nuclear provocation, he's definitely going to be slapped with even more strong sanctions. So I don't know if his Pyongyang policy will be enough to get North Korea up and going for a long time.
You talked about people in key positions in Kim Jong-un's executive committee. Kim Jong-un's sister, can you tell us her name and where she's from and more about her for our listeners who are listening to this?
Good point, Jack. Well, as for Kim Ya-jung, she's Kim Jong-un's new sister, like you just mentioned, and she's been appointed to the Central Committee of the Korean Workers' Party. Now, this Central Committee is responsible of supervising and organizing all party affairs and manages finances. It was definitely a key committee within the party. Her new position was one of the things to closely look out for because she was originally the deputy director of North Korea's Propaganda and Agitation Department that leads idolization projects related to Kim Jong-un. And if we look at her political career, she made her debut in 2014. And she's been spotted frequently in the public assisting Kim Jong-un. So her new post is definitely going to let her more public in the public eye.
Do you think from the Congress anything in North Korea is going to change?
Well, officials from South Korea's Unification Ministry says absolutely no, because Kim Jong-un used this rare political event just to reaffirm North Korea's status of a nuclear state. So officials here are saying that there was nothing new. There was no new vision for North Korea. It was basically a huge political gathering within Pyongyang to just solidify young Kim Jong-un's leadership.
What's the reaction of the South Korean public? How do they react to North Korean issues like this Congress?
The general public is kind of ignorant to North Korea, I guess. I think it's mostly the North Korean experts that closely watch for any political events happening within the regime and South Korean officials. But definitely, the military, of course, is definitely keeping a close eye on any further provocations of perhaps a possible fifth nuclear test or any kind of provocations within the demarcation line that happened back in August. So since North Korea has always kind of continued its threat against South Korea, it's kind of a regular thing. It's kind of a routine thing for South Koreans in general. But I think it's mostly the South Korean officials, the military officials in South Korea that are keeping a close eye on North Korea.
That was Connie Kim from Arirang TV. Now, the intrigue of the North Korea Congress was further heightened by the news that over 100 journalists from across the world were to be given rare access, and perhaps even unprecedented access, to North Korea themselves. Well, that was the original idea. What I call the great North Korean journalist scrum meant that when the day arrived for the Congress, journalists, and dare I say a few bored ones, were shut out of the Congress altogether. One of the world's leading journalists who was inside tweeting and in fact doing the first ever live video from Pyongyang was Anna Fifield, the leading journalist on North Korean affairs from the Washington Post. Anna is a veteran North Korean follower, and I spoke to her and asked her about her experiences visiting North Korea live for the Congress itself.
I've been 7 times over 11 years, so it's kind of incremental change in North Korea. But I mean, the thing that really struck me last time, and even more so this time, was just how good Pyongyang's looking, basically. There's so much construction, people seem to have a more leisurely kind of attitude about them. I think they seem to have more disposable income generally, and these observations are of course confined to the capital, which is also where I was confined to. But I think my observation is that I think that if I'm a resident of Pyongyang, I have even more reason to be happy and even less reason to rock the boat in any way.
And you mentioned there about disposable income and economic reform. That was kind of the big crux of the conference. Do you think that North Korea is on its way to becoming a Chinese-style market economy?
I really do not. I mean, we have seen quite a few changes over the last 10 or so years in terms of market economics, but they are so tentative and so contained. And I just think, I mean, this is a regime that runs on a like family, dynastic, personality cult system. They can't afford to open up too much without risking that, I think. So I think that we've seen these very gradual changes where people are more and more allowed to feed themselves, which is a big deal in North Korea, but we're not going to see any sudden vast opening. And I think the way that Kim Jong-un has been completely rebuffing China these days is evidence of that.
Just going forward to this media carnage, because all I seen was on Twitter was, and I'm sure some of the listeners will have seen, journalists not being able to get in. Were you ever promised to begin with that you were actually going to get into the Congress, or did you expect to see more than you did?
Yeah, I mean, it's North Korea. We never know anything. We're never promised anything. And frankly, I did not expect to get into the Congress. I thought that anything where the leader is present is very sensitive, and to have 130 of us going into that building on the day that he was there, I thought it would never happen, and it didn't happen. So I wasn't too surprised by it. Of course, I was disappointed. I would have loved to have been inside there. And on the final day, a handful of select journalists, not including me, did get in there, but it was a very small group. So no, I wasn't surprised.
And you were told, I've just read your recent piece, that you asked too many questions. I'm sure no one has ever said that before, Anna. In light of Rupert Wingfield Hayes obviously being detained, were you scared at any point that you were pushing the boundaries a bit too far?
I wasn't scared, but I was conscious of it all the time. I think, when I'm there, I just tweet and write and whatever, what I see and what I would do as if I was anywhere. I feel the duty to be upfront and honest with my readers about what I'm seeing. So I just continue to operate as I see fit. But this Congress having the leadership component to it, the fact that this was Kim Jong-un's big kind of consolidation party, he was very much front and center, he was promoted from, head honcho to head honcho, basically. Clearly it was a big event for the leadership, and that has extra sensitivities around it. So I was just conscious of it, but it didn't change my coverage in any way.
The world's first ever live Periscope from North Korea, I believe it's the world's first, was done by yourself, Anna. Can you tell us how that came about?
Right, well, I'm very interested in social media, like myself, and as a newspaper, as a company, the Washington Post is very experimental and trying lots of different mediums and different ways to reach, our audience and younger audiences. So we had been talking previously about doing a Facebook Live, and I'd said, if I get into North Korea, that would be a great place to do it. But it being North Korea, we weren't sure how the technology was going to work out. And so I was on my 3G North Korean SIM card the whole time. There's no Wi-Fi there. And the connection was very spotty. So it was hard for me to get a connection strong enough to do live broadcasting. And just some things, like I wanted to do it off the main Washington Post page, but that page was too heavy for my phone to load. So I had to do it off the world page for the Washington Post instead. So it was a technological challenge. The calls dropped out a few times, but I thought that it was worth persevering even through the patchy parts, because readers, audiences seem to be enjoying the opportunity to see, you know, see North Korea, see what I was seeing.
It looked awesome, I have to say. You documented on your Twitter page some strange experiences. I noted the massive TV you've seen at the airport, for the listeners who may not have seen it. And you also documented some strange places you visited, I think farms. I mean, what was the kind of strangest experience for you?
The strangest experience, that's a tough one. Many of the places that we went to, I've been to before. The hospitals and the wire factory and things, I went to those places in 2005. So a lot of the actual places were not that weird for me. I know that North Korea doesn't have many many places to show off to journalists, so they have to recycle all the ones that they have, and you know, the places that they show up off are not particularly impressive, so I wasn't so surprised about that. I think the weirdest thing was being part of this media pack, there being 130 journalists, all that TV gear, you know, everybody jostling, everybody want to get in first to this press conference that we thought we were going to get to and didn't go to. I think just being part of a huge media scrum in a country that is so media unfriendly was the weird thing.
What did the world learn about the Congress? Was there actually anything in there which we didn't know already?
I think we learned that Kim Jong-un is very much in control. I mean, this whole Congress was about him showing his leadership of the party and therefore the country, him showing how he had consolidated his power, how all these octogenarians from his grandfather's generation, you know, how he has them under his control. I mean, that seems to be mostly true, or even completely true. Like, he was this very strong show of strength there, I think, in much faster than his grandfather managed to consolidate power. And really striking that, you know, Kim Jong-il never once gave a public speech. And there we had Kim Jong-un speaking for 3 hours, wearing a Western-style suit and tie. It was really kind of breathtaking that how relatively open he is being with the people. And also, I think the way that he announced the economic plan and talked about the economy very much gives him ownership of that issue. So if in 5 years' time or something, things are not working out as planned, I think people can maybe not lay the blame with him, but he has the responsibility for that. He has ownership of that issue. So I think it was pretty bold.
Final question, Anna. North Korea itself, do you see Kim Jong-un's rule, do you see Kim Jong-un's power base secure enough to keep him in power for a long time? And I know it's a fool's game to guess what's going to happen in the future of North Korea, but if you had to say, as someone who's visited so much and someone who knows so much, what would be your main predictions?
The thing I've learned about North Korea is never to make predictions about North Korea. You know, I didn't think that the regime would be able to survive this transition from Kim Jong-il to the third generation, and 5 years later, they're going relatively strong. So I've been proven wrong on that. I certainly see no signs of instability in North Korea, no signs that anything is underfoot, that his grip on power is anything less than iron-fisted. I don't expect any sudden change anytime soon in North Korea. That sounds an awful lot like a prediction to me. I hope you don't regret saying that. But I don't see any signs of change.
That was my interview with Anna Fifield from the Washington Post. If you don't already follow Anna on Twitter, you can do so. Anna's Twitter handle is @AnnaFifield. And Anna's also on Facebook, where you can see the live interview she did in Pyongyang, the world's first ever one. That's on you can just find it, Anna Fifield on Facebook. So every week on the North Korea podcast, run in partnership with The Diplomat, we ask one of our guests 3 key questions about the Korean Peninsula. So this week, I asked Connie Kim whether she thinks North Korea will ever collapse, and if so, when.
I think that's the question I've been asking very much to officials at the Unification Ministry. But what I've been hearing frequently is that some change needs to happen from North Korean people itself. So basically, that's probably why the Unification Ministry is trying to give a lot of humanitarian aid, support to North Koreans, to let them know that a whole new different world is outside from the North. So I think if South Korea, if it happens to, if South Korea keeps on providing humanitarian support, aid, for them to realize that there is a much different world outside Pyongyang, I think it could happen, but I can't say for sure when exactly.
Do you think Korea will ever be reunified?
I think that goes along with the question that I just answered about giving sufficient humanitarian aid to North Korean people. So if Kim Jong-un, I don't know, if a military coup happens within North Korea and nobody is there to grip power within Pyongyang, I think North Korea's traditional ally China is going to make a diplomatic move.
And what is the strangest story you have ever heard from North Korea?
I don't know if this is the strangest story, but what I found very surprising is the intensity of strong labor they get from prison camps.
So that's the end of this week's podcast on the North Korea Congress. Thank you very much for listening. You can put a comment on the iTunes store, or you can also follow us at the NK Podcast, or you can follow me at JackHands1 on Twitter. Have a great week, and 안녕히 계세요.